a contract to build the Ryanair website, put in front of Michael O'Leary and Michael Cawley and basically the entire senior team, and grilled about building a website. Michael O'Leary said, like, so do you think this is something that you'd be able to do for us? And I said, yeah, let me go away and put some thoughts on paper. And what I learned, a very valuable pricing lesson, because I quoted them 20 grand. The next cheapest quote I found out later was like 3.5 million.
How are you? Welcome to the Entrepreneur Experiment podcast with me, Gary Fox. Today, my guest is John Beckett. Fun fact about John, he built the very first Ryanair website when he was still in school. He's the founder of ChannelSight. He's also the founder of Nature's Trust and Forestry Partners, which aims to combat climate change and reforest Ireland. Here's my chat with John. Over the past 5 years in this podcast, I've spoken to so many amazing Irish businesses who started from a single idea and grown to become world-class companies, able to compete with the very best on the international stage. And many of those started and grew with the help of their local enterprise office. From starting up to growing to becoming more sustainable or digitization, your local enterprise office has everything you need to make that happen for your business. Visit localenterprise.ie or click the link in the podcast description. If you've been listening for a while, you know Iconic Offices have been my partner for ages now. Working and recording out of their flexible workspaces has meant a huge deal to the success of this podcast. So it made perfect sense to partner up with them again for season 17, but to give you, my fellow entrepreneurs, a unique offer. Come work in the Iconic Office workspaces for free with no catches. Simply visit the link in the description below and enter Gary24 for a free day pass or a free day office pass. Enjoy.
John, welcome to the pod.
Thank you. Great to be here.
We've had an extensive pre-chat.
We did.
We've saved the planet. We've improved our parenting skills. We've done a lot in the last 30 minutes.
I'm really impressed. We should do this every week.
Probably should just start recording when people come in. Welcome to the pod.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Great to have you. I've followed your journey for a while. I've seen you speak a couple of times. It's always an entertaining chat. You have an interesting backstory. Start us at the start, because I think you've a really good origin story.
So at the start of my entrepreneurial journey, yeah. Where I was when I was a kid.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I've always been entrepreneurial. Like it was kind of, I was born with it. And I think when I say born with it, I think I was just good at selling. I think that's the only thing that I kind of, the only skill that I had really ever was selling. But I started when I was a kid just trying to sell stuff. I actually started with Buy and Sell magazine, which was a magazine pre-internet.
Yeah, you know, I used to buy it every week.
And I'd literally just read it for inspiration, trying to find some kind of hustle that I could do with zero capital and being eight. You know, what can I do to try and make a few quid? But I suppose then I got a bit older. I got a job in an internet cafe then, building the computer network. I taught myself to build computers and use them when I was a kid. And then I did that in an internet cafe for a summer. And then I set up a business when I was 15, where I'd buy computer parts in the UK and I'd assemble the computer and sell it to local businesses. And that evolved into building websites and for local businesses. And again, this is kind of late 90s, where websites were kind of this, nobody knew what they were. It was all very strange and exotic. So did that for a while and then won a contract when I was sitting my leaving cert. Won a contract to build the Ryanair website, and that was, that was something that I still get asked questions about.
It's a great story.
25 years.
It's a brilliant story, because I remember reading about that way back in the day. I'm like, oh, legend.
Well, it was literally, I got asked to go in after school by Eddie Wilson, who was in HR at the time, and I knew from living out in Howth, and he said, look, I know you're building these websites. Would you come in and have a chat to us? And I came in and had to meet Eddie. I went in after school one day. Thankfully, I wasn't wearing my uniform. You know, I put on jeans and a t-shirt and went in to meet him. And it turned out I was put in front of Michael O'Leary and Michael Cawley and basically the entire senior team, and grilled about building a website. And so they said at the end of this meeting, Michael O'Leary said, like, so do you think this is something that you'd be able to do for us? And I said, yeah, let me go away and put some thoughts on paper. And I came back to him and I learned a very valuable lesson. It was a great project. And I still, you know, I still know Eddie, brilliant guy, and have a huge amount of respect for Ryanair and the team. But I learned a very valuable pricing lesson, because I quoted them 20 grand. And
which probably sounded like the world to you.
Well, I was, you know, broke. I was kind of a student, you know, making a few quid, building kind of tiny websites for local business. So 20 grand was a lot of money. But the next cheapest quote I found out later was like $3.5 million.
You know, Michael O'Leary loved you.
And he haggled over the $20,000 as well.
Did he?
Yeah. So fair play to him. But it was a great, it was brilliant. Like I'm still talking about it 20 plus years later. So it was a great big break.
But when you look where they are now and you look at the origin of you building the first, that's immense. Like that's such a cool story. Like
it was a great part of great to be involved in that. I probably made more money from shares. I should have asked for the original money in shares.
It's like the story your man asked to paint the Facebook office and took it in shares.
Exactly. Yeah.
So how did that like first project set you up? Like what was the kind of like the thought process behind it? Like how did you get on as a young student?
Well, I decided at that time because we launched it in March 2000 and I was hitting my leaving cert in 2000. So I stopped studying and I said, look, this is what I want to do. I didn't have a huge desire to go to college anyway. So I decided to use this break as a launch for the business. So I kept on doing that and really never stopped. One thing led to another always. And have had plenty of pretty significant failures along the way.
What was next after the Ryanair website?
I continued building websites and okay. wanted to get into software and building a product. So rather than a services business, I wanted to get into product. So I built I skipped a lot of school. As a kind of to give context, and I became expert at skipping school, at how to skip school, signing my own notes that I wrote to get myself excused, modifying roll papers to say that I hadn't been absent when I had.
Was that you'd no interest, trick. Or you were doing other things, or what was that?
No interest at all. Like going to like Irish class was pass Irish, the pass subject that I did, and it was. Like, this is just the absolute pits, as far as I was concerned, doing these subjects that I had no interest at all in. And I had an interest in doing something very specific that was somewhat productive, you know, elsewhere. So I became really good at skipping school. And I came up with this idea for a product called Truancy Guard. And we built, it was an early biometrics product. So
you turned into a snitch.
100-turn gamekeeper kind of thing, yeah. So, so it was. The idea was that we'd sell this product to schools. We got this hardware, this fingerprint scanning, which is obviously ubiquitous now, but it was really cutting edge back in.
A little bit dark as well. Fingerprinting all the kids on the way in.
Well, we actually used, and I'm still using the quotes that I used back in the day. We used the Data Protection Commissioner's guidelines for the use of biometrics in the workplace as a cornerstone. To develop our product, and there was all these dodgy kind of Chinese tech that was just photographing fingerprints and storing them. We actually weren't. We were these little kind of minutiae points on the finger, and that we were just scanning those and encrypting them, and then we were comparing one encrypted file to the other. It's all very standard.
Oh wow!
I haven't looked at biometrics particularly in years, but this was really cutting edge. And we sold it, bootstrapped it, and got it. I think we'd sold it to about 12 or 15 schools. Was going pretty well. It was a great product. I had set up a business in Malaysia in the interim period after leaving school. A guy I knew from Gateway 2000, where I'd worked for a summer as well.
My first computer.
There you go. The cow boxes.
Yeah.
He was based in Malaysia, Dutch guy, and so we decided to kind of set up an early outsourced operation. So we had the team down there, and then we had the business side of things here.
What age were you?
Probably 19 or 20. Yeah, but it was.
I love how you said this is so logical. Kind of like this is so obvious.
It was. It was a really. Like this guy was down here. He had these people based in KL down there in this Cyberjaya, which is now this enormous. You know, it's completely transformed over the last 20 years. But we had this is what the team that we used to build this software, and it went really well. And we'd it was a great little business. But unfortunately, the plan was originally to sell it to kind of 20, 30 schools here and then use that to get into the UK. And I'd started having meetings with the Department of Education in the UK. It was gone reasonably well. There was a half page article in the Sunday Times profiling this technology and myself. And the journalist, who I won't name, and he's a lovely fella, but he misquoted me in this article. And where I had said what I said to you a minute ago, the data protectioner, you know, we had used the data protection commissioner's guidelines for the use of biometrics in the workplace to develop the tech, he shorthanded that to the data protection commissioner has approved the technology, and the data protection commissioner was unimpressed, to say the least, with this. He wrote to every school saying the tech was illegal.
Oh.
And put us out of business overnight.
Oh my gosh.
So that was pretty, and we had no backers, you know, so that was we ran out of cash pretty much straight away, and had to shut down. The frustrating thing about it was, looking back, I can think of 20 things I should have done, but I was actually pretty sick at the time. I had a kidney transplant in 2010, and so I was at like end stage renal failure, kind of it was approaching.
Jesus.
And my brain just kind of didn't actually work that well at the time, so I was kind of not firing on all cylinders. So I couldn't actually think of the kind of, you know, think really strategically. So it was really frustrating. Now I can think of a lot of things I would have done, and maybe there's a bit of hindsight and a bit of maturity and experience that helps with that. But that was my first really big failure. I'd personally guaranteed a load of debt, which again is something I wouldn't recommend. And I think I had like 200 grand, which was just a overwhelmingly large amount of money at the time, and you know, maybe the banks at the, you know, were foolish to give it to me, but either way they had my name on the page, so I had all this debt that I needed to contend with. So that was a pretty tough one.
I'm not even sure where to go. I think we've done 350 episodes, and I think that's the first time my brain is still trying to catch up with what you just said. That's wild.
It was it was pretty unpleasant, and then so I had no choice really but to go again. So we set up Airtight, which is still around, as a software company, which ultimately ChannelSight was a spin out from, and just structured the debt and then repaid it over about 5 years.
So what was the next business then? How did you go back to
building software. So partnered with two guys, and we co-founded Airtight, and we started winning business for building more complex. We worked with large companies like Dell was a very big client of ours, and we built internal software tools, and that was, again, allowed the debt to be repaid. I did a year with no salary, which was pretty unpleasant. Again, then I had the transplant, which was challenging enough, but it was great for building resilience. It's a great few years.
You know, looking back on it, it was a great few years.
it was tough enough at the time, but
I can imagine, like, never mind the 200k debt is serious, but like then factor in like health issues and things like that on top of that, like that's a huge challenge. And you said something really interesting there. We'd no choice but to go again.
Well, I like, what else am I going
to
do?
Well, I think a lot of people would have fled to safety. They would have fled to the safe harbors of a job or something like that.
It never would have even occurred to me.
I love
to be honest
that.
With you. Like I think one of my teachers, and again, I didn't get on with a lot of my teachers, and you know, I think it was my French teacher or somebody said that I was fundamentally unemployable in school. You know, nobody is ever going to give you a job, and I kind of.
Took it to heart.
But I took it as kind of a, yeah, that's great.
Great. You know, sounds like, exactly what I want.
Exactly, yeah, yeah. So, I didn't consider getting a job, certainly, no.
And how did you, like, because you said so many kind of, like, things there as if they're complete logic. When you started again, like, building internal tools for large companies, like, how did you even figure that out, that was a problem?
Like, there's always so many ideas. I don't know, if you have this where you have all these ideas of what you would do next and kind of what businesses you could run. And then there's the opportunistic stuff. So I think it was Kieran and Rob, these two guys that I co-founded Airtight with, and I think they were doing some work with Dell already, and that they weren't too hot on the commercial side, and I was pretty good at the selling side, but you know, didn't have a team to build out the tech. So I think that's how we came together, actually. And then we built out the commercials on the back of the kind of case studies that we had with Dell. We were working with Rabobank and a load of other kind of big corporates to build their systems.
And then you mentioned your current business was a spin out of this. How did that come about?
And we founded ChannelSight in 2013, and having built out a product from 2012, that was so we'd started working with Philips. So again, my approach to this kind of thing is sell it first. You know, once you've got a queue of customers down the road, then you know you're probably onto something. So so we'd sold this idea of this where to buy product to Philips, and then worked with them for nearly a year.
What was the idea?
So the where to buy tech is a widget that sits on any digital content that a brand is pushing out. So it could be their own .com, it could be ads, social media posts, video, whatever it is. So that when a user is engaging with that content and develops a buying intent for the product that they're looking at, that they can quickly and easily and frictionlessly see how to find a retailer that has that product in stock that's relevant to them.
Yeah.
So, for example, you're looking for a new TV. You search Google for televisions. You see Philips TV that looks pretty good. You go onto the website. You're looking at their, you know, the video and all of the content and the spec. And you decide, okay, this is the TV for me. What do you do then? So you might go back to Google and say, I want to buy this TV. And you see a load of ads for, you know, UK retailer, or you see an ad for a link to a different TV. You see competitive distraction. Or you might go to a retailer. You might go to Amazon and search for that product when you're going to get then ads and listings for other products. So there's a huge amount of friction. Philips has invested all this money to get you to the point of wanting to buy it. And then you're off into the ether and they're hoping that you find it. So what this does is it takes your attention and it brings you through to the product purchasing page on the retailer. So you convert. But then so that's pretty easy. The concept is pretty easy. Delivering that at scale across hundreds of thousands of SKUs or products is pretty tough. But where it gets really interesting then is we've built relationships with thousands of retailers around the world, so that when a conversion happens, so when you know you're looking at this Philips TV and you go on to Currys and you make a purchase,
yeah,
we know about that.
Okay.
So we're able to report that back to the brand, and therefore they're able to reallocate budget based on what's working to drive sales. And
that's interesting. Yeah, because it's funny, as you said, it's a little bit different now, but I remember like buying Sony cameras and stuff and Canon cameras, and you go on a Canon and you'd be like ready to go, and if you're getting there, you'd be like, I see all the cool marketing material, the ad that costs millions. And I'm like, there's nowhere to go. I can see the specs. I can see everything. And I'm like, just stuck there.
Yeah.
And like you said, new tab, off distraction. And then you're like, oh, I wonder how it compares to...
And cameras is a really good one, because it's usually specialised retailers, right? So, yeah. So they were late to the party in terms of selling really
very
well
much so.
Online.
Yeah.
So that's a really good example of where it's not particularly done very well, because there's, again, thousands of SKUs. You might need specialist advice, you know, so you need to go to people who know what they're talking about. But if it's a tough friction filled process to get you over the line at the end of the
yeah
line
so
cycle.
you figured out then a way of just streamlining that through bringing the person through, because when you get to like the authentic website, the trust is there now, and if you can guide me through, I'm going to continue that trust. Even if you're bringing me somewhere else, I'm going to trust that that's
and it's typically like the retailer that you trust. So if you click buy now and you see a list of retailers that have it in stock and you see the price or whatever, then you click on your preferred retailer. You're going to somebody who you've probably heard of, or you might have a relationship with, or you're getting points with, or whatever. So,
yeah.
You know, it's again that kind of question over who am I buying from? Is this legit? Is kind of diluted significantly?
You said the brilliant thing there, and I think it's how all entrepreneurs should look at things: is removing friction. People think about the best product and the best this. Often it's just removing friction,
big time.
Making it easier, because people are so savvy now. People know pretty much what they're looking for. Mm. But sometimes, like, you go through a process, you're like, Jesus, web, there's 15 steps here. I just want to book my parking.
Yeah, I know.
You know, you just, and then now I got to get my phone out. Now I got to swipe the thing. Oh, the pop-up didn't come up that time, so I got to do it again. Yeah. Like, there's so much. And, like, it's wild. Now, how do you think of it now? Because there seems to be so much friction. I was even setting something up for my dad over the weekend. Every time he comes up to me, he's like, I need you to do something for me.
Job for you.
And I'd be like, okay, what's your Apple password? I've no idea. Where is it? It's in a book. Okay. So I set him up with LastPass. But I was trying to set him up with that and the banking and stuff. There's so many
banking
points of friction now.
Appalling. They're just so appalling. Like,
it drives me crazy.
Like, I can't. It's almost like it was designed to be bad. You know, like
it's appalling.
It's so bad.
I would rather write off to up to 200 euro, up to 500 euro.
Yeah.
I'll take getting hit for a scam for 500 euro.
Yeah.
If you just stop asking me.
I'm only allowed to pay 1,000 euro for 2 days. Yeah. What?
That's like, I'll take it. I'll get hit for the 500 euro. If you just stop asking me to swipe, and an AIB goes through the two different screens, and then you have to go through it again, and then you have to validate, then you have to get your little handheld
thing.
Even the thing
when you're buying something online, and I'm Bank of Ireland, but you have to authenticate it on the app. But then you have to also put in the password.
Yeah.
Like, it's me. I'm on the website. I've got my phone. Like, yeah. You don't need a password as well. Like,
it just feels over-engineered. Yeah. It just feels so over-engineered. And I get it. You know, they're trying to make things a lot safer, ironically, to make it easier to buy online. But it's just made it so much harder.
Well, like, the likes of, and I'm not a fan of Revolut, because I got randomly kicked off Revolut by Revolut. And the excuse was, we want to choose who our, we can choose who our customers are. So I got
back. Bit harsh. Seemed like a nice lad.
Like, they asked me for my, all my, you know, they practically needed a medical exam, and I gave it all to them, and then they said, we're not going to work with you.
Really?
So like, and I've been kind of, and they, there's no kind of recourse. You just, do you wish to appeal this? Yeah. And of course you appeal it, and there's like, your appeal has been rejected.
You see, that's the and only then, benefit banks have. They just
cut you
off.
Yeah. They cut you off. Like, and then your app is gone. So like, that's where I'm pretty suspicious about the likes of Revolut, where they can do that. You've got effectively no recourse. Mm. And the service has been, you know, just appalling. The app is great when it works, but yeah, they're able to just do that, you know. And so you're kind of, that's one good thing about Bank of Ireland. You can kind of,
it's the only thing kind of keeping them going, I think, is that you do have some recourse. You can ring up or whatever. Yeah. But the new modern apps are going to figure that out pretty soon. One call center in each country. It's not the biggest overhead in the world.
Either way, I'm permanently banned, so I'm stuck with
that. Well, you've no choice. You're blacklisted. So, but it does, like, these are the kind of areas where I look at and go, there's still so much scope for entrepreneurs to come in and provide massive value. So what was, so that was Channel Site then. Is that how Channel Site started?
Yeah, that was in 2013. And then we raised our first fund. So we, again, bootstrapped that. We sold it to Philips. Then
did you, you hive that out of Airtight?
Yeah.
Why?
Because I knew I'd never done kind of a venture back startup. Everything had been bootstrapped. The biometrics business had cost me pretty significantly by bootstrapping it. And I wanted to try a venture backed company. So we bootstrapped it up to the point where we had de-risked it to a point. So we had three really great clients: BSH, which is Bosch Siemens, we had Mondelez, and we had Philips.
Wow.
And then we then we raised money. We raised €3.3 million in 2015. And that kind of, then we were off.
That's chunky money.
It was a good first raise. Yeah, but that was you know, we were capital efficient with it as well. So we raised another, it was $10 million at the time in 2019, so 8.3 or 8.7 million euro, and then we've raised some debt as well. But that's all we've raised.
What was it like going through the funding process for the first time?
Massive learning curve, like. It was really like, I went to some of the Irish VCs and again, John Flynn lives out near me, and I kind of knew him, and I met him, and he gave us an indicative offer, like, kind of, this is where we'd kind of be. And I said, look, I'm not happy with the valuation. I'm not greedy. I don't want to, you know, the most important valuation is the valuation you get on exit, right? Like, but I want to, you know, I think it's worth more. And he said, go to London, see, can you do better? So I did, and I commuted to London. So there used to be that CityJet flight that left just, like, it was, you could make it from the taxi to the plane in 5-10 minutes max, and I'd get up an hour before the flight. Like, I had a dental fine art. I'd go to London twice a week.
Wow.
At one point, and just met probably 100 VCs and got, so that was in itself a brilliant learning curve. It took a lot of meetings to get some offers, but we were oversubscribed in the end. I think we were 5 times oversubscribed at the end. And then so it was led by a brilliant firm. And honestly, it's culture is something that we take really, really seriously, and getting the right people in the right roles. And that starts at the board. You know, it starts with investors. So if you can get the right people around the table, it makes such a difference, because we've been through plenty of ups and downs since 2015. And having, so we have John Flynn ACT, ACT followed, and they followed the second round as well. They've been brilliant to work with, you know, and Nauta, who led the first round, have been an unbelievably good partner. And a lot of people complain about VCs, rightly. Some of the stuff they do is really sketchy, but these guys have been brilliant to work with. And then Connected Capital came in from a Dutch firm based in Amsterdam, came in to lead the second round in 2019. And again, they've been brilliant to work with. So I've had a very good experience with them. It's, you know, there's no messing, like, they're out to make money.
Yeah, obviously. Well, it's a clear, yeah, clear business relationship.
But so long as everybody understands each other,
I think it comes back to the thing we talked about earlier about doing the reps. Like, you did 100, 150 plus meetings, and we talked about earlier about pattern recognition.
Yeah.
So after 150 meetings, you've got a fairly sick sense of,
you know, within 2 minutes if it's gone well or if it's not, you know. Yeah, definitely.
And what were you looking for? What was your kind of, like, what were the key things you were looking for in a partner?
I think the number one thing in our first round was that we were all sitting on the same side of the table when we had a problem, because there's definitely going to be problems. So if you're kind of reporting to the board once a quarter and you have to go to a meeting, you're getting given out to because you've missed your numbers, and then you're coming back in, you're going back into the business, like, phew, I made it through that meeting. Like, yeah. that's not what I wanted at all. Like, so I had never done this before. I wanted to work with people who were interested in the business and interested in solving interesting challenges. Like, I ever want to do is work with really intelligent, interesting people who I get on well with on really cool problems, right? And I wanted the partners, the funding partners that we've worked with to kind of fit into that. So that was the first thing that we looked for, kind of that cultural fit, that and that kind of willingness to lean in. And then like when we were doing the second round, I went to SaaStock here in Dublin, and I'd spent about a month prepping for it, and had over 40 meetings just in those 2 days in that investor kind of area at the back. And I just went from meeting to meeting. And again, we met, connected, and they had looked at two of our competitors and passed. So they knew our space inside out, and they knew exactly what the problems with our competitors were. So we, like, again, within 5 minutes of sitting down, I knew that they were going to invest it, that they were very likely to give us an offer, and that they were a good fit for us because they knew the space so well. And they did.
I think it's really interesting there about SaaStock. I mean, you spent a month preparing. What were you preparing?
Yeah. Meetings. So I think it's pointless going to events just to walk around. Like, unless that's what you want to do, right? You want to go to events, see a few speakers. That's fine if that's what you're going for. For me to take the time out to go to 2 days of an event, and it's great if it's in Dublin, but if you're traveling for an event, you're going to the cost of the flights, the hotel, the time out. You want to understand why you're going, right? And to me, if I'm going to this event, I want to set up meetings. So these investors are trying to deploy their capital, right? They have a job to do as well. They want to meet companies that they think there's a good fit for. So I just spent a month on the little app, kind of reaching out to people who are relevant, doing a bit of research on the people I thought were a good fit, and then setting up meetings. So it takes time to set up meetings.
I love how you've taken the bootstrapped approach to a venture-backed business, though. I think that's really, really interesting. I think too often you see bloat and you see kind of like sloppiness come into venture-backed businesses because they've got the money now and they're like, I was going to name a conference there. Let's go to the X conference for like 5 days and spend $10,000 on a booth.
Yeah.
You're like, oof, is that the best use of capital? But then they don't really, if they've never done a bootstrap business, you see capital deployed in very strange ways in early stage businesses.
Yeah.
I said this to the previous guest. It was like, red alert for me is if they've swag before they've profit. I'm like, yeah. If they're giving out like goodie bags and hats and stuff at the, I'm like, oh gosh,
yeah,
that's probably not the best use of the investors' money.
Yeah, well, there's growth. Like, I mean, if you're growth at all costs, you know, burn is completely irrelevant. Just get the growth. That's fine. And we were a little bit like that for a certain period where money was really cheap, and we were well funded, and it was just get the growth, hit the numbers. But now it's, and the world has totally changed in the last 12 or 18 months. So now it's EBITDA, right?
I love how Silicon Valley have now invented this thing called sales and profit. Yeah. Now suddenly they're only backing things that are profitable. And you're like, wow, what a weird concept.
Who knew? Yeah.
Customers, eh?
Yeah.
It's mental. Yeah. It's so interesting to watch like what's happened since COVID, because I think what's happened now, I was thinking about this the other day, and I kind of think what's happened now is what we thought would happen in COVID.
Yeah.
We thought to be tightness. We thought to be restriction. We thought to be like a drive towards profitability. And instead, everyone just went bananas and just threw money at everything.
Yeah.
Whereas now people are going, ooh, better just check now. There's enough runway there. Ooh, yeah. Are you profitable?
Yeah.
How many customers you got?
Yeah.
Whereas like it just, it blows my mind. But I love this idea. I love the philosophy you took from the bootstrapped into the VC and how you approach raising the money.
It's stupid to waste money. Like, you have this money, you can do some great things with it. And don't get me wrong, we did loads of stuff that was a poor use of money in hindsight. We made really bad hires. We did things that we wouldn't have done. We invested in building a kind of functionality that we probably shouldn't have, you know, versus something else. But I mean, we also did our best, you know, to do that. So it's worked. The business is still growing well and it's profitable now, thankfully, as well. So,
and how did it evolve? Because I love the fact you had three customers. We had Charlie from Bounce Insights on last year, and his philosophy was, which he took from someone else, can't remember who the original person was, and it was like, listen, sell, build. Yeah. It's a great, so simple.
Yeah.
Because most entrepreneurs build, then go out to market and go,
I need to think about customers at some point?
Yeah. Then go out to market and go, oh, but you must want this because, you know, we've built it now and we've all these functions. We've all these extra things where the customer's like, that one piece is useful. The rest,
I'm not paying for that.
Not so much.
Yeah, yeah. But like we are ruthless with that now. So we look at, like, we have a roadmap and there's so much on it that we think is great and that we've designed and think that this is a good thing to kind of conceptualize. But everything goes in front of customers, and everything, and particularly we have, you know, champion customers where they're really interested in the roadmap, they're really interested in what's coming next, and they're kind of pushing for things. So we have a constant battle in our kind of product board where we have kind of sales team who are looking for something. We have strategic planning from the product guys saying, well, this is where we're going. So it's this kind of really healthy friction where we're trying to ensure that we only build the things that are likely to have the highest impact.
It should be survival of the fittest, though, shouldn't it? It should be like, this only gets done if it's going to massively move the needle or it's solving a huge issue for customers.
Maybe. And the accountability as well. So what we had years ago, we found, like, somebody from the sales team, and there's no criticism of the sales team here, somebody from the sales team will come in and say, like, do you know what? If we had this, this guy would sign, right? And we go, okay, well, we should probably think about building that. And then, of course, they don't sign, right? And we built this thing. And we had a load of this kind of product bloat, which was just functionality that kind of we thought or customers were using as an excuse to pass on doing a deal because it didn't have this. So bringing accountability into this. So, okay, we're going to put in, you know, one sprint for two guys to build, for two devs to build this and all of the associated go-to-market and QA and UI building and all the stuff. But you've got to then make sure that there's a commitment. Your name is beside this now. So, you know, and it's not to beat anybody up, but it's to keep people kind of... keep them honest in the best possible way, you know. So if this isn't something that's needed, don't shout for it, right? Let's use those resources to build something else where somebody is willing to put their name beside it.
Elon,
and you need to have that psychological safety, though. You need to have people willing to make this mistake.
You can't remove risk. You can't remove risk. You can't remove the option of failure because you have to fail. Yeah. Elon is like persona non grata at the minute, but he has that beautiful logic of don't name a department, name a person.
Completely.
And it's brilliant. And I see that repeatedly with great entrepreneurs that come in here. It's all about personal responsibility for themselves, first of all.
Yeah.
They're not like pushing this out to like, oh, it's on you. It's on them first. But then they're like, well, if I'm putting my name to it, you're putting your name to it.
Yeah.
And if you're going to call for it, then we're going to attribute that to you. This is going to be your project. If it fails, it fails. Mm-hmm. But you'll own it.
Exactly.
It won't be like, we should do this. And then it goes up on a whiteboard and then it goes to 50 other people. And by the end, no one's like,
why do we build that again?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think that's really, really important. And I think a lot of bootstrapped entrepreneurs keep that at their ethos because they've had to survive on, we don't have two devs.
Yeah.
We have zero devs. this is outsourced. You know, we're trying to build this. So how does ChallengeSite make money then? What's the business model?
Hey, we're just taking a quick break from today's episode to shout out our main sponsor. If you've been inspired listening to this amazing business person and either want to start your own business or supercharge an existing one, then the local enterprise office has something for you. Whether you want to improve your online presence, become more sustainable, get into new markets, or just get that idea off the ground, they have the support for you. For more information, check out Local Enterprise Week or log on to localenterprise.ie and see how they can help your business. Now, back to the episode.
So enterprise SaaS. So we sell to large brands. We have about 500 large brand customers in 70 countries now. And they do a kind of a minimum 12-month contract, and they're billed based on the number of retailers that we're connecting to, the number of brands that they have, and the number of SKUs or products that we're processing for them, and then there's various other kind of packs that they add on to that as well.
I think it's a very interesting business because like it's kind of hidden in plain sight. It's one of those. Probably everyone listening has used one of your products without even knowing it.
Yeah.
I love those kind of businesses. They're in the middle serving a critical function in the B2B space. Like it's fascinating because in Ireland especially, there's loads of them. I mean, the only people keep saying, oh, you'll run out of entrepreneurs. I'm like, no.
That's not.
Just because you haven't heard about it.
Yeah.
Just because it's not like a famous brand name. It's everywhere.
Yeah.
Especially B2B, like the amount of software we talked about, the banking system there and earlier. Like the amount of software we use on a daily basis now is monumental and only getting bigger and bigger and bigger. It's a huge opportunity
we do it every year. We do a call of all of the, and we've actually implemented a new process to stop anybody being able to sign up for stuff, because if you look at and you go by the credit card statements. It's the easiest way to do it. And you just say, here's all of the stuff that we're paying for. You know, how many Dropbox subscriptions do we have across the company? You know, all of this kind of nonsense. And some of them are critical. Like, you know, we use SharePoint or whatever. But there's so many that somebody signed up to because they had a credit card and the ability to be able to sign up for some AI tool or something.
You know, 50 quid a month.
But yeah.
And you don't really realize it.
Them, you know, like it's literally like it's amazing. So regular call of this stuff is a good way to dig up some cash as
I think it's interesting. The guys at 37 Signals, Jason Fried, they're doing that once model now. They took the Slack code, essentially, not Slack code, but they built like they had a version of it was a messaging tool way back in the day, and they built it out. It was part of Basecamp that they'd kind of hived off, and they kind of died because Slack came along. Yeah. They're like, damn, that's way better. That's way better. Just kill that. And now they've kind of gone, wait, if we like brought that back, made it just a bit better, you know, polished it up a little bit, and companies pay for it once. So that's their whole thing now. They're pushing this once model of like, pay for it. It could be like a couple of grand, but then you loan it. It's like old software.
That's where we came from. We've come full circle again, right?
I thought it was so interesting. I heard him. I heard a pod on there last week. Really clever guy. My God. But the way he was saying is like, yeah, we've gone the whole way around. It's almost the way though, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
Like emails back.
Not sure I welcome that.
Yeah, I know. But like it's funny, you always go right the whole way around again. Like what's new is old again. Mm. I heard a great quote a few weeks ago. Technology changes, people don't.
Yeah.
The psychology of how we use things doesn't really change that much because we're hardwired to want the simple option, to want things to be frictionless.
Absolutely.
It's like the Bezos thing of like, let's look at them, what has to be true for this to work. Will people want things cheaper? Yes. Will they want them faster? Yes. Continue.
And let's build a flywheel around that very simple psychological model. Like,
exactly.
Yeah.
Whereas, and I like the way you said, like, you know, it's overbuilt. A lot of stuff's overbuilt. You're kind of going, I don't need, like, the app to do, like, a million things. I need to do one thing really well.
Exactly.
I want to be able to send payment from me to you.
Yeah.
That's it.
There's a load of just bloat then around that in most products.
And you don't use most features. You kind of sign up for all the stuff, and you're like, oh, that's really cool.
Even if you look at how many apps on your phone do you actually use? Like it's like 10.
Yeah, you know, my iPhone like was out of space one day and I was trying to do a quick video for something. I was like, oh, they're like, oh, do you want to offload apps? I was like, yeah, I'll just hit that just to make sure it works. Then I offloaded them and then I saw them on the screen. I was like, I haven't used most of these in like
years or since the day I downloaded them in some cases. Yeah.
Or maybe you've used it once.
Yeah.
For one thing. You're in London or whatever and you just download this app.
Yeah.
That's why I always, when new entrepreneurs go to me, oh, so we're going to build an app. I was like, do you need to build an app or could you build a website?
Yeah, exactly.
Could this be a website? Yeah. It's like, you know, this meeting could have been a phone call.
Yeah.
It's like that thing is like, this app could have been a website.
Yeah.
I think that's true though, as in like, just build the bare functionality, like, because the friction.
And then when you get the demand or it's working, then build it into an app that you already have a client base for, or you already have a bunch of people shouting for this, you know?
Exactly. Because the
very
friction.
Very rarely do you have people shouting for something and then you build it and they show relief. You know, that's what you kind of really want it to be.
The attention span is so short now.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? To download an app, people are like, meh, seems like a lot of work.
Even or they download it and they never open it, you know.
Oh, I have to sign up. Oh, I won't bother.
Yeah.
You know, so you really have to like be careful when you're building things out. And then you've got like, your LinkedIn is brilliant. You have a lot of stuff going on.
Actually, less now because I try to cut.
Did a call.
Everything. I did to. Cool, because you just you spend so much time dancing between different things. So, I try and keep it to kind of a narrow focus.
You've done multiple ventures along the way, though, haven't you? Since with Airtight and between Airtight and Channel Site,
there's been a few kind of small things. And then I suppose over the last few years, then getting more into the kind of looking at the impact, and I'm particularly interested in climate change. Terrified might be a more appropriate word, but interested in what we can do. About climate change. So,
where did that come from?
That's a good question. I suppose 2015-16, I started thinking about the fact that it was going to be. I always assumed the government would fix this. The government will fix climate change, right? And around 15-16, I started thinking, you know, I don't know if they will. You know, and then you look at them; they can't build a metro, can't build a hospital, can't build. The government struggled to do a lot of things. How are they going to solve this super wicked problem where you need to change behavior and attitudes at a mass scale while eliminating all of these very powerful vested interests? I don't know if they do have it in them. And then I started looking at, well, what can I do and what can we do on channel site? So we started looking at decarbonising our own activity. And then we started looking at, well, what are, is the low-hanging fruit here for other stuff we could do? And started looking at forestry. And the stats were pretty compelling. Like, so average forest cover in Europe is 40%. In Ireland, it's 11%. The native woodland cover, so a lot of the forest in cover in Ireland is commercial. So these sitka spruce, they're basically growing timber. Only 2% of the cover was native woodland, and the ancient woodland was nearly gone. So we thought, well, like, that's something that we could potentially do. So I kind of very naively said, like, just buy a field and plant some trees, lads. This is kind of,
well, it's easy. The entrepreneur way, like, draw me a line between the cause and the effect.
and like, of course, you know, inevitably, that was significantly underestimating the complexity of this. You've got to get effectively planning permission. You know, it's very slow. Land conveyance in Ireland it's an emotive topic, and it's
awful.
It's very, very awful. Slow and expensive. So we kind of persevered with it, and I set up Forestry Partners, which is a not-for-profit to do this, to enable us to leverage the learning curve that I had gone through with the team to enable others to contribute funds to the same cause. So we did that, and we launched an Irish Tech Goes Carbon Neutral kind of campaign in 2019. And then we got chatting to the not-for-profit arm of the State Forestry Company, Quilcha. It's called Quilcha Nature, and headed up by Kieran Fallon there. And myself and Kieran met a bunch of times. And long story short, we decided to set up this JV called the Nature Trust. And the Nature Trust is an entity where we seek to raise, rather than the kind of 20 grand, 30 grand that we were raising from the companies that I knew, and the kind of the SMEs, we created a financial instrument called the Woodland Nature Certificate. And we offer 100-year contracts to large corporates. So the first funding that we raised, €2 million there 2 years ago from AXA, raised €5 million last year from Aviva. We're closing another funding round now.
When you say 100-year contracts, what does that mean?
So we will plant, we'll buy land, we'll put it into trust, overseen by effectively an entity of with state participation. So you've got Quilcha Nature, which is part of Quilcha. So I might not be around in 100 years, but hopefully the state will. So we can offer 100-year contracts that we will create a native woodland, and we will ensure that. We will manage it initially for 25 years of reporting. So we'll give reporting on the progress in relation to carbon sequestration, biodiversity uplift from the forest. But we'll also open it as public amenity access. So cycling tracks, hiking trails, all sorts of other things that you know, there's all sorts of ideas that we could do, whether it's bees, we could put treehouse Airbnbs, I don't know, whatever it is, right? But all focused on maximising the positive biodiversity and climate impact. And this is a kind of a win-win-win situation. So we're helping climate and biodiversity. We're helping local communities where we have these amenities and these these really positive kind of forests that we're creating. And we're helping the corporates to be associated with the benefits that we're creating. And so we work really closely with local communities. We're not trying to impose this. We're not trying to compete with farming. Like, the climate change is such an enormous problem. This politicization of it, this idea that it's you know, urban versus rural.
Yeah,
you know,
it's super emotive. It's really so emotive for good reason. Like, it is, like you said, it's such a huge problem. But at the minute, it's so emotive.
It is
pitching people against each other, especially in Ireland at the minute. I think globally, but I think in Ireland especially, there's a lot of them versus us at the minute.
Absolutely,
and across every issue.
But if we can take a step back from that and look at the vested interests that are trying to create that, to create that and sow that discord. If you look at, you know, you go in and fill your car up with petrol and you're seeing carbon neutral fuel, and you know, we're planting 10,000 trees. You know, I can tell you, 10,000 trees cost about 20 grand, right? It's a nonsense that this is, like, they probably spend more creating the stickers and putting them on the petrol pumps, and this, so this these lies, this absolute nonsense, this greenwashing, really makes me, it really pisses me off, right? Because you've got people then who maybe aren't thinking this front of mind, and they're just going, carbon neutral, sweet, You know, that's grand.
But how do people know? See, this is it, because it's funny, because you kind of have to, you can't go through your day questioning everything. But I think you kind of have to believe a little bit of what you're told. And also, people probably don't want to think about it. Kind of want to go,
usually the reason people are kind of scared by it are people who kind of understand it, first of all, like the scale of the challenge and the tipping points that are approaching, and the potential outcome that if we don't do what's necessary. But if you, I think actually once you start to engage with looking at solutions, it's really empowering. And that's how I've approached it, and it's looking at all the brilliant entrepreneurs creating incredible companies. And what can we do? So, like with the 2050 Accelerator, I'm very closely involved in that. And with the Dogpatch guys, we're bringing and supporting entrepreneurs and bringing large corporates here in Ireland into helping these entrepreneurs test and validate their tech. So Ireland is a small country, but as a result, we don't have the scale that you'd have if you were in the States. But you do have the connectivity. You know, you can get in front of anybody in Ireland. Mm. You know, so can we put you in front of somebody who can help you validate this technology really quickly?
Yeah, this could be a huge positive, because we could be like the perfect test bed.
Completely.
Because we had this reputation of, green Ireland and, you know, healthy and blah, 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 which we are. I mean, some of the food and stuff we have here is best in the world.
Absolutely.
So we could have the best country in the world for testing these ideas.
And that is absolutely the vision here. So yeah. Ireland is a brilliant country to do this, but you do need the policy support. You do need the incentivization.
And how do you get that then?
You need to get leadership, good leadership, to kind of support.
How else to get
vision
that?
Of this. Like, yeah, it's
that's. I think I'm not political, but I think anything that has a shelf life of 4 to 5 years, very unlikely you're going to get a massive change, because again, we talked about earlier. Show me your incentives, I'll show you your outcome. Their incentives are to get reelected.
Yeah,
you know, of a life term of 4 to 5 years. With the best will in the world, like a lot of them do go in with good intention. That's going to be fairly low down their list. How can it make an impact for the next 100 years? It's not the Japanese version.
Look, there's messaging and communication around that. Like, you need to try and move beyond this us versus them and the politicization of the entire issue, and say, here's the facts, here's the science. Now, if this is real, and let's assume you want to question that, right? And the science is pretty hard to question at this point. You know, the studies that are really questioning climate change now are heavily backed by vested interests like the oil and gas industry. But so if you take the vast majority of credible scientists are saying that this is happening, what would we do if it was true? And run a citizens' assembly around it. Run get engagement from all of the relevant stakeholders. Bring everyone together and have that kind of really factual conversation. If we go in with these assumptions saying this is happening, what do we need to do? What can Ireland do? And, so we need policy support. We can create policy test beds and sandboxes for people to come and invest in Ireland and create their products. This is a massive, the biggest, in my opinion, commercial opportunity that has ever existed for Ireland. And for the next 20 years, you know, it's we have FDI, we have the amazing job that our leaders, our glorious leaders did in creating Ireland as a kind of a hotbed of tech innovation. That's brilliant. We've got a brilliant foundation. Now, for the next 20 years, let's look at making ourselves the global, trying to, because there's a lot of countries trying to do this. We don't have an open field here.
Yeah.
Let's try and do what we can to make ourselves an absolute leader in innovation and in climate solutions.
And the Greens seem to have screwed the pooch on this one, because they've got such a bad PR rep now. Any proposal they put forward is automatically getting poo-pooed because, it's the Greens. Whereas in reality, it should be the other way around. It should be like the most innovative, the most straightforward examples we're getting.
And look, I'm not political either. I don't have any affiliations, right? But I think their hearts are probably in the right place. It's just maybe the messaging and the approach.
Well, no one's cycling to work through Dublin, because you're going to get killed. So, like, you have to be realistic. We talked about incentives there. You made a great point earlier about, you know, the incentives on a personal level. I think it has to start there as well. You have to empower people and go financially, because everyone's pinched for cash at the minute. You have to go, well, financially, it's a no-brainer to be great.
Look at what they did in Italy. Right, so they have 110% grants for putting solar on your roof.
How does that work?
So, well, like, if it costs 10 grand to put the solar panels in your roof, they're giving you 11, right? And then you also have your electricity savings and all the money you're saving.
Amazing.
So they've made this almost ridiculous financial incentive.
I think it has to be, though. But I think it has to be outrageous.
It's unquestionably worth doing.
Yeah.
Right? So this thing is massively subscribed. You know, everybody is doing it. And you know, it doesn't need to be 110%, but make it 100%. Right? People are already saving a fortune. I put solar on the roof a few years ago, and it's amazing. Like, I don't pay anything in electricity. I charge the car. It's brilliant.
Because I looked into it during the summer, and my dad got it, and I was like, oh, I must look into it. And because our house, the way it's shaped, it's kind of flat in parts, which is a nightmare at some points, but it's perfect for solar. And I was like, oh, it's way more expensive than I thought it was going to be. And I was like, oh, I'm going to shelve that now.
Absolutely.
Because
so it should
too
be just
pricey.
You shouldn't get a bill. You should just sign it away. And maybe it's even if they paid it back out of your electricity savings.
Exactly.
You know, like, make it so that it's not costing the state a fortune if you don't want to give 110% grant, but at least make it so that it's a no-brainer, that it's compelling to do.
You talked earlier about it has to be like a war situation. In war, mad things happen and you do things you'd never do. This is something that should be done, as in make it so obvious that you're going, you don't have solar, you moron.
Yeah.
Like, it has to be that if we are going to make massive change.
Just, there's so much that we should be doing. Like, even if you look at the drop-off recently in electric car sales, you know, I can understand it. I can understand if people, and I don't have range anxiety. I've driven an electric car for 3 years. I've never really had range anxiety. I mentioned I went to a wedding there, and I looked up online, you know, is there a charger beside this venue? And there was. So Grant headed down, and the charger was a cone. You know, the thing had been ripped out. So, like, and then I had a problem. I had to start finding, you know, how am I going to charge the car? There should be, again, a warlike mentality. If this is... if we accept that this is a problem, and if we don't accept it, then let's go back one step and say, what do we need to do to accept what this problem is?
For this to be true, what must happen?
Exactly.
Yeah.
If we accept that it's a problem, then why on earth are we not taking a kind of a war mentality to fixing this? There should be chargers in every lamppost. There should be solar grants to make it an absolute no-brainer to install on every commercial and residential premises. There should be X, Y, Z. It should be, here's what we're doing. The kind of mess of the wind power off the West Coast. I mean, it's laughable. If it wasn't so tragic, it'd be hilarious, right? We have all of this power and all these resources there, and we just can't get our act together. We need to do a lot better.
And I think the problem is people get overwhelmed and they think they need these big, mad, crazy solutions. When in reality, it's taking what you already have, improving it, and making it obvious. That's where real change comes from.
Like, a lot of the solutions already exist.
Yeah.
Right. So, you know, put the windmills in, the turbines in off the West Coast, put them off the East Coast. We've done a lot of research. We've been talking about it for years. You know, make public transport free. You know, like, they've spent 3 years building a cycle track through Fairview. 3 years. The Japanese would have this done in 24 hours. Right, like it's literally, it is not as hard as we seem to be obsessed in making it. You know,
we are making things a little bit hard for ourselves. Like you said there, like, you know, you're doing forestry that's as old as mankind, but yeah, you just need to do it at scale. So what's kind of the goal then for this Nature Trust forestry? Like, where would you ideally like that to go?
Look, the Nature Trust is I think something that can hopefully be something akin to a national institution where everybody loves it,
yeah.
Right? It's creating great resources that everybody benefits from. There's not an ounce of profit, not a single penny of profit in it for me or anybody. It's all cycled back into the projects. There's no expenses even paid, right? So we did that so that we're operating as a glass box. So corporates can give this money. They know it goes into these projects where, you know, annual reports that are published. You know, this is supposed to be something where there is just, it's beyond question. We're trying to do good. And inevitably, we will make a mistake along the way. And again, it's about holding your hands up and saying, we've made a mistake. This is what we should have done. This is what we're going to do to make it right. It's how we do it in channel site. It's how we do it in anything. You know, nobody's perfect. You make mistakes. It's what you do after you've made the mistake to fix things that really is important. So that's the intention for it to really, we'd like to have 1% of the country under management. Over the next 15-20 years, it's a billion euro project. But I think it's one that's really worthwhile and everybody should benefit from.
I like it, and I think it'll resonate with a lot of people listening, because it's very tangible. That's what I like about projects like this. It's very tangible. You can see it. You can go out. There's a forest. We built that. You can go and enjoy it. And I like the fact you're bringing in the kind of the public usage into it as well, because, like, thankfully people are now so much more active and everyone's enjoying the outdoors. Again, I live out in Wicklow, so, like, we're spoiled for choice. Mountains, sea, beach, you know. Yeah. But, like, the more chances you give people to embrace that, the more they will. It's just giving people access to all these facilities. So talk to me then about ChannelSite. What's kind of the goal for the next kind of couple of years with that?
Well, we're investing now in what we call predictive analytics. So we're taking the vast amount of data that we've captured over the last 11 years now and building out a system where it's machine learning, it's data science, it's very, very heavy technical stuff. But where, rather than reporting on what has happened, we're now beginning to pre-report on it. So if I have $100,000 to spend on a campaign, where should I allocate that money to have the highest impact? So rather than spending the $100,000 and say, this is how it worked, it's predictive. And that's really the holy grail for a kind of...
Minority report for spending your money. This is what's going to happen. It's going to be a future crime. This is going to be a future spend.
Exactly, yeah.
I love that quote. I know 50% of my advertising isn't working. I just don't know which half.
Which half, yeah, absolutely. And that's ultimately the problem that ChannelSite is seeking to solve.
But you see that a lot. Like, you see that, like, with a lot of... Like, I was chatting to a friend of mine who's in e-commerce yesterday. He goes, yeah, the ads aren't working, I think, but I don't even know why.
Yeah.
And they were, and then they weren't. He says, I actually don't know why. This could have been a Facebook update. I don't know.
And it's so hard. Like, so everybody has the same problem. And it's about trying to figure out, what can we do to give the most visibility possible into what's working, or what's going to work, based on, again, not just a couple of kind of data points based on what the brands, but 11 years of billions of euro worth of transactions and across many, many markets and hundreds of brands.
That's phenomenal. We'll do a quick fire round. What book would you recommend every entrepreneur must read?
There's loads. Like, Anything by Ryan Holiday, I think, is brilliant.
You're speaking my language.
Ego is the enemy. The Obstacle is the Way is probably my favorite. But my favorite book is Viktor Frankl, Man's Search for Meaning.
Yes, very good.
It's just amazing. I think it's about prioritizing and about understanding what's important in life and really helping to get your head straight. It helped me. I've read it a number of times. I read it every few years. And it really helps me to understand what's important in life. This guy wrote this when he was in a concentration camp, and wrote it from memory. I won't even tell you what happens in it, because it's just fantastic.
It's an immense book. And really, Ryan Holiday, I'm just the biggest fanboy of him. Just love everything about him, his work ethic, how he writes, the style of writing.
And there's a couple others as well. I'd say Invisible Women. It's a brilliant book by
I've never heard of that one.
Criado Perez. It's about how the world has been designed by men for men.
I have heard about this, but it's never been recommended.
Shocking. And it's like in terms of what we've learned. Like, we made changes. I read it a few years ago. In ChannelSite, it really changed how we approach so many things. Like, it's, women die much more often in car crashes because seatbelts were designed for the male body.
Yes, I've heard this.
Drugs are tested on men, and women have always been assumed, or were usually assumed, to be just small men. So they got kind of a lower dose, but they're fundamentally different. So, like, medicines are less effective. It's about the biases that are built into every product. And as we're building out AI and all of these new technologies, you have these biases becoming more ingrained. It's absolutely fascinating and fundamentally changed how I think about building products and trying to root out biases. And the fact that you're aware of bias, you think I won't be anymore, you actually get more biased in many cases. So that's brilliant.
It's phenomenal. Every time we have women entrepreneurs on the show, like, just the stories they have, and you're just going, that is absolutely shocking. And since we've had our daughter, I'm just so much more aware of my actions and, like, the future actions of, like, how do you make the world a little bit better for her? So I'm definitely going to read that. That's a brilliant recommendation. Thank you so much. What's the biggest thing you've learned about yourself since starting your business?
I think more resilient than I probably thought I was. So there's been tough days. for a number of for a number of personal and professional reasons over the last 10 years or so. But actually just getting up and taking the next step is the only thing you have to actually do. So you there's always the, like with venture backed, you're always thinking about the exit, or you're always kind of encouraged. The VCs are talking about the exit, you know, are we going to hit this valuation? What's happening? When that becomes too much, just get up, get dressed, and go and do something that you think is productive for just that day. Achieve one thing, you know.
I love that. Yeah, don't think of the 10x, think of the 1x. What's the one thing that I must do today? I love that. What valuable business is no one currently building?
Oh, there's so many. There's just so
many. You're the kind of guy who's like a book with like a, you have a Notion doc with all these written down.
So many. In Ireland, something kind of working on this biochar is a carbon removal. It's basically you take old biomass, a waste biomass, and you pyrolyze it, which is you heat it up to kind of 700 degrees in an oxygen-free environment in this pyrolyzer, and it carbonizes this biomass, so it looks like charcoal. But what that's doing is it's breaking the natural carbon cycle, where a plant grows, it dies, and it withers away, and the carbon that was captured in that plant goes back into the atmosphere. You're breaking that by carbonizing it into kind of charcoal. Oh. And this product, this biochar, has immense value and uses in decarbonizing concrete, in encouraging, you know, reducing flooding and along water courses, and stopping runoff. There's literally a million things. There's another brilliant book called Burn, by Albert Bates and Kathy, somebody well worth reading. It's one of the best books I've read recently. So in Ireland, I'd love to see, and I'm actively involved in trying to see that becoming a reality.
Very interesting. I'd never heard about this. What would you do today if I give you 10 million euro?
I would probably put it into genetic research technology company. So looking at how can we solve genetic disorders. And, you know, there's somebody like the Mark Zuckerberg's foundation is working on this, and as somebody who's doing it on a grand scale. But I think there's loads of opportunities at kind of identifying kind of rare illnesses and potentially genetic fixes for those, and that's going to become really big over the next 5 to 10 years.
What's something in your daily routine you wish you started sooner?
There's loads of things, like, you know, I wish I'd started meditating or cold exposure or, you know, all of that kind of stuff earlier. That's helps deal with stress. I actually think kind of memento mori and thinking of my own mortality is I find some people think it's depressing. I think it's kind of motivating. You know,
I have an hourglass on my left hand.
Oh, nice one. There you go. I have a little thing on the screen on my laptop, which is just a timer. It's tiny. It's just the number of days I have left, assuming I make it to 90, kind of thing, you know.
I went for 120. I was
Yeah, well, as the tech improves, yeah, you see? I'm gonna up that.
That's, you know, my chart. 120 is my chart.
Nice.
Yeah. I think you have to. People do find it depressing, but I do like quarterly plans quite a lot, and I sit down the quarter and go, right. And then that's it. I don't allow myself to think about it again.
Yeah.
Execute, review weekly, but don't be like constantly thinking. But I think once quarter, sit down and go, right, where are we going? What's the big picture here?
Yeah, completely. I do exactly that. And I think actually, thinking about your own kind of mortality, if you want to spend the day doing nothing, you know, fine, right? Embrace that. It's good for you. If you want to go out and waste a day being, go out at night and waste a day being hungover, go for it. But do it consciously.
Yes.
Right? Don't just forget about it. Just think that
don't sleepwalk
through
life.
Investing one of my X number of days in being hungover.
Yeah. I said this all the time. It's a choice.
Yeah.
Everything you do is a choice for good and for bad. You got to live with that. I love that. I'm going to give you 1 million euro, but you can only invest it in one company or one person. Who is it?
There's so many. I it's so difficult to name one. Like everyone loves, like Bobby Healy is just doing such a cool business. You know, so Mana, but you know, Norman Crowley, like Cool Planet is just like he's kind of under the radar. It's amazing work that he's doing. But there's so many kind of other businesses, like Charm Industrial, 12, they're making chemicals out of thin air, you know, decarbonizing in the US, Heirloom, another cool climate company.
Put your money where your mouth is. Give me one recommendation. I gotta go write this million euro check right now.
Probably Carbon Stack. There's a great business came out of 2050 called Carbon Stack. They're doing this
Carbon
really,
Stack.
Yeah, really, they're startup. They're raising funds now, and that's you know, they're really interesting.
Okay, right. The first million euro Fox Fund check will go out after this. Terms and conditions apply. May not be legally binding. If you had to start a new company in the morning, what would it be?
I think it'd be the biochar company.
Okay.
Certainly something climate related.
Okay. What do you believe other people will find strange or strongly disagree with?
I think climate change and biodiversity breakdown are going to fundamentally change life as we know it, and it's going to reach a, you know, particularly with biodiversity stuff, you know, you're going to see that sooner. But I'm very concerned about where we're going, and our kind of the trajectory that we're not changing in relation to what we need to do to minimise the prospective impact of what's happening at the moment. So I think a lot of people would disagree that it's going to be catastrophic, or they kind of think they're putting their head in the sand, or they're not looking at the science, or they think the government is going to sort it out. I think people need to kind of wake up to the reality of that.
What's one thing in your personal life you spend money on that brings you immense happiness?
This is going to sound kind of boring, but I love gardening. Right, I love plants. Right, there's nothing I love
after
more.
The conversation we've had. I think the biodiversity thing. We'll let you away with this one.
I love going to the garden centre and like especially this time of year and buying a lot of flowers and hanging baskets and stuff. I spend a fortune on this stuff, but it brings me great joy. I love sitting out in the garden and just enjoying the stuff.
There you go. Simple pleasures. That's what it comes back to. What's your final piece of advice for every aspiring founder or founder listening?
I think, look, there's so many things I've learned. I think failure. I've never learned anything particularly useful from success or successes that we've had. So the failure and problems are always where the learnings sit. So, but also failure is not a destination anybody wants. So it's how do you turn your failures, understanding how your failures can become kind of a stepping stone on this journey to success, you know, is you know, so embracing failure for what can be learned from it, rather than seeing it as something that is very depressing or disheartening, which it often is at the time, but moving on from it.
It's only failure if you stop.
Exactly, yeah.
John, that was such a pleasure. Where can people learn more about you, about Channel Site, and then about Nature Trust?
So naturetrust.ie, Channel Site, SIGHT.com. I'm on Twitter, John Beckett, or LinkedIn.
That was a pleasure. Thank you so much,
John.
Thank
you for having me.
I hope you enjoyed today's episode. If you did, please hit subscribe on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts, as it really does help the podcast grow and reach new people. If you want to learn more about the podcast, go to mrgaryfox.com. I'll see you back here in a couple of days for a brand new episode.